Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
I want investors to understand technology investments are always going to be an aggressive investment. It's not like Southern Company or Georgia Power where you've got these power lines and it takes years to build the infrastructure and you've got all this manufacturing that's there. And it's hard to compete against that. But from a technology standpoint, you're always at risk that somebody comes out with a new, better technology.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this Finance U. This edition this week, we are talking with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management, and we're very excited to dive in. Today, we're going to be talking about the deep dive that we just saw in the markets. Is that a top? Is it a tradable bounce? Where are we? What are we looking at? What does it really mean from a portfolio standpoint? We got to look as well at Trump threw out this crazy, wild idea that maybe no more income taxes. If that happens, I'm going to have to analyze it, but I can tell you right now, I'm going to change my tune. What's my tune? Buy everything, don't look back would be my tune if that happens. That would be one of the most bullish things I could imagine. As well, I want to do a little bit about oil. We're going to take a look at those oil inventories. But Scott Bessent, the incoming Treasury Secretary, he's got his hands full next year. So, Paul, so good to see you again. Welcome
to
the show.
Chris, it's my honor.
Yeah, well, together we make the show. So thanks for being here. I was talking with somebody yesterday who knows Scott Bessent, says he's very, very smart, very schooled in history. Like if you want to understand what was happening in the 30s or the 20s or the 1800s, he's read it. He does his homework. He knows a lot. I think he's going to have to know a lot because you have a very interesting chart that shows the challenge he's up to this year. Could be a big year for him, don't you think?
It's going to be a big year. So the prior administration had obviously no knowledge of history with Janet Yellen and some of the decisions that were made there, right? I guess they think we're so bright today compared to the future that, you know, there's nothing to learn from the past. But he's going to need all of the lessons from history and the wisdom that it can give to get through the little grenade that they left for him that we'll show later in the show here.
Yeah. Janet Yellen is an economic vandal. She left a mess. I'm really disappointed in her as a human being and as a Treasury Secretary and a Fed Chair. I think she's done a lot of damage, generational damage, countrywide, nation level. It's been bad. I hope he can clean it up. We'll see what he can do. So let's get started. Remember, this is a Finance U episode, everybody. This is going to be going out on January 30th, so we're almost into February of 2025. And Peak Financial Investing, that's the website. So if you want to talk to Paul and or his team, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com and fill out a simple form, and Paul and or his team will get back to you in 48 business hours. And Paul, I understand you're kind of busy now. So if somebody did fill out the form, how long might it take to actually get to see you right now?
So one of the things right now is because I'm concerned about the potential volatility and a lot of the changes that are taking place, I'm keeping a lot of capacity in my schedule so that we can deal with existing clients quickly when they get in. Because, you know, our industry, unfortunately, spends too much time trying to get new clients and not taking care of the clients that they have. So we're keeping a little extra capacity in there. So it's about a month right now to get in on my schedule. And I know that can be frustrating for those individuals that we're not working with, but it makes sure that I have the capacity to take care of the clients we got. Once I get through, and I'm being very proactive in talking with everybody right now, making sure they know our outlook, where we're going, so that we can get there. That's kind of my top theme here at the first of the year, because I do think we're going to have a lot of volatility this year. So, you know, and then if you're flexible, once I get through, if I have some extra capacity, we can slide somebody up in that schedule. So just know that for those people who are interested in working with us, that if it is appropriate and we're a good fit to work together, once you become a client, you are top priority and you can get in a whole lot quicker. So that's just a way of doing for others the way I'd want to be treated, because if I stack my schedule up with people who are clients and I don't have the time to take care of the clients I've got, I'm not doing a good service for those people that, you know, I'm responsible for helping them make wise decisions in the days ahead. So I do encourage you. You're interested, just be patient. Once we get to you, at least at this point, I've not had anybody say that it was not worth their time, because we do, you know, we take you through the whole planning process and really give you a deep dive. And whether we work together or not, we're giving you information that can help you be a better investor and make wiser financial decisions in the days ahead.
Well, I think it's going to be really important. You say volatility, that's code speak for, uh-oh, sometimes markets go down to the right instead of up and to the right.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I have to tell clients every now and then, hey, volatility is your friend, right? I'm not scared of volatility when we're playing offense, because CDs, you know, go sideways and they don't move. You get your fixed term. But if inflation's double what CDs are paying you, then that lack of volatility is an enemy to you. So volatility is your friend when you're on offense, but when our tools say defense, we don't want to experience volatility, or we mitigate that volatility.
So let's switch now. I want to talk about DeepSeek, right? The Chinese thing that came forward. And so listen, I'm no AI expert. I read enough to be slightly dangerous to myself potentially, but here's the bottom line that I took away from what I read, Paul. They very cleverly re-engineered a few of pieces of the code for a typical AI program, and they achieved an astonishing 95% reduction in the need for what are what's called inference computing. So you need big chips, NVIDIA H100 sets, giant data centers pulling gigawatts of power. Oops, 95% less of that. So that's big. And I've already talked with people in the industry, Paul, who say that because they made it open source, they're like, hey, here's what we did. And already they've started to implement that across everywhere. It didn't, this changed everything. So this is the nature of a new technology. It's disruptive. We should expect that. But the U.S. had been pursuing this one model, which was big, big tech, big data centers, big this. We're going to just supersize it. And that's the moat. That's what keeps everybody away, because little guys and gals can't jump the moat. Well, guess what? Little guys and gals can jump the moat. And that's fascinating. I'm a big fan of what I think AI is going to do for us in terms of efficiency. This isn't what I'm talking about now isn't that. It's just the rush to build out this gigantic infrastructure that was going to require gigawatts of new nuclear power and gas-fired power plants and massive data centers. And oops, maybe not so fast.
Right? Yeah, maybe not so fast. You know, if I could summarize it, the U.S. is acting like a third generation trust fund baby. They think money is going to solve everything, right? So we're just going to spend as much money as we possibly can, and we're focused on going down this direction. I'm not saying that there's no creative thought, but there's not this real creative thought. So U.S. being third generation trust fund baby, tons of money to spend, doesn't respect the value of a dollar. Let's just throw money at it. Then you take China, which because of the restrictions on them and the lack of access to chips and technology, they kind of remind me of MacGyver. Did you ever watch that MacGyver show?
Yes.
Years ago?
Yes.
So for those of you that may be too young to know what MacGyver was, he was this one guy that could take literally anything and get out of a situation. Like, he would take duct tape and pencils and build a nuclear reactor. I'm exaggerating, of course, but it was amazing as a kid watching. So what they've been able to do with less resources, and I know there's the argument that they stole whatever from ChatGPT and the evidence may be there, but even if they did, they've open sourced this out there for everyone else. And that goes back to kind of how, when I was competing, I always would train and help my competition, because if my competition was better, it would push me to be better. So I love the fact that they put this out there at open source, and it really appears to be a game-changing event. Now, I think the passive investing and the $4 that are going into NVIDIA and some of those others is masking what really is probably going to take place under the surface for now, because that mutes the market. But I do believe that this is a game changer, and it's a reminder. I want investors to understand technology investments are always going to be an aggressive investment. it's not like Southern Company or Georgia Power, where you've got these power lines and it takes years to build the infrastructure and you've got all of this manufacturing that's there. And it's hard to compete against that. But from a technology standpoint, you're always at risk that somebody comes out with a new, better technology. So, you know, an extreme example is, what if Microsoft wasn't able to buy a company that had such detailed voice commands that you never had to type and you never had to touch a mouse again? And, if, you know, and let's imagine that world where this other company produces that technology instantly. It's a game changer. So this is just a reminder for investors that, you know, you might be confident in some of these technology companies, but because technology moves so fast, everything can change overnight, essentially. And it appears, based on the information I'm looking at, Chris, and you know, what's your opinion, that this is a long-term game changer?
Well, it absolutely is. I think we're looking at something as transformative as the early internet in terms of what it could be, but it's early. Right. So when the internet first came out, it was like 34 people sort of communicating with each other, you know, across little wires. And it was very cool. And today, you know, it is what it is. Nobody could have foreseen any of that. It's an emergent process. So I'm going to sharpen up what you said a little bit. And I'm going to say it's a guarantee. The technology, whatever you're invested in today, is not going to be what's around tomorrow. Right. You know, it's just we went from Betamax to VHS to DVDs to Netflix, right? All that other stuff is gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just,
it is
just disappeared. So here we are. So this is pretty cool. Now, what happened? DeepSeek announces this thing. Actually, got announced the week prior. Somehow it took Wall Street to Monday to figure this out, right? But when it figured it out all at once. And we saw this is the single day market cap loss in billions of dollars from Holger Schuplitz. There's the Twitter feed. NVIDIA clocking in at a at one point it was well over a $600 billion loss, but I think it closed up a tiny bit on the day at the end. Broadcom, $200 billion haircut. Taiwan Semi. So we hit semiconductors, we've hit switching companies, we hit a chip manufacturer, and they're more, NVIDIA's more than that. Microsoft, like nominally a software, but also a data company. Alphabet, Oracle, look at these things. Then we get down to Amazon, and now look, Constellation Energy, further down, Schneider Electric, further down, over here on this one, Siemens Energy, Trane, which is a cooling, heating and cooling company, I believe mostly, et cetera. So what I'm seeing, storage companies, NuScale Power, I believe that's got new nuclear, small nuclear reactors, that was on there. I'm surprised I don't see the other one on, there should be one more on here. Wow. Pretty big deal, huh? So power, HVAC, networking equipment, this hit everybody. It says that the narrative before this little Chinese company said, oh, hey, here's some stuff we did. The narrative was on big data centers. The narrative just changed. Welcome to investing.
Welcome to investing in technology and the knock-on effects of when that changes. You know, and Chris, we had gotten to the point that the narrative around AI had become so pervasive and investors were feeling so much fear of missing out. Like, this is, and I think a lot of it just has to do with the fact that inflation's been high. A younger generation of investors cannot afford to buy a house right now. Rents are so high. So they're speculating in many areas, trying to get ahead in some way, because they're already so far behind the eight ball. But, you know, I was amazed, like, fixed comfort systems came into one of our portfolios back around mid-August. And, you know, as you look through it, I'm like, oh, that makes sense, because it's, you know, it's one of the largest HVAC heating and cooling and piping companies around. And of course, it was decimated on that day. And what's interesting to me is a lot of these stocks that were decimated, and you're hearing this news, though it's not that big a deal. You know, Altman and some of these others are coming out and saying, yeah, you know, this is not necessarily this big game changer. But the stock prices have not rebounded from that major decline. They're just, you know, in general, they're just floating around within a range of where they are. So the market seems to be looking for more information right now and a little hesitant to assume that this is just the buy the dip opportunity.
I just want to take a quick break right now to tell you about my Information Scout service. At Peak Prosperity, I'm holding this really important role of being your Information Scout. Now, what does that mean? First, I do what I do because, as we all know, this world is really crazy right now. We don't know if our food's going to continue to be stocked in the stores. We don't know if the grid's going to stay up. We don't know if a war's going to break out. So being resilient is more important now than ever. And the first element of being resilient is knowing what you need to know, having that right information. So listen, you could get a news aggregator service. That's not what I'm offering here. I go in and I find the data, and I'm going to present you that data, and I'm going to hang it on these things called frames to make it simple and easy. The feedback I love the most that I get from my subscribers is that I save them time, they understand what's happening in the world, they feel more comfortable knowing what's going on, even if they don't always like the results of what they've just learned. But most importantly, they take action as a consequence. So it's time for you to become resilient. It begins by being well-informed, and that's the service of me being your personal information scout in this complicated, fast-moving world. Now, let's get back to our program.
It's interesting. You know, here's a longer-term perspective. This is a couple years of the NASDAQ, and you can see here, let me get my little fancy pointer lasery thing. This is that low we keep talking about on October 30th of 2023. And it's just been like, this is pretty much a big old straight line. So even that big clock down on Monday, it's just, we're just in this little box right here. Nothing fancy. It's like for this year from starting from December, you know, we're just barely through January. So, you know, December of last year, we're stuck in a range. Close up. Looks like a decline, but honestly, that was as much in a single day as we saw over a couple of days back here in early January. Again, no great shakes. You know, really, honestly, what was interesting to me was looking at Oklo, which is a small nuclear reactor company. And by the way, I just found out today that the energy secretary sits on the board of that, or had sat on the board. So he's versed in small modular reactors. Bloom Energy. Yeah, that's good, right? I think it's good. You know, but what's fascinating is how fast 6 days ago, when I took this screenshot, I took this yesterday, Bloom Energy sees Wall Street price target raised amid data center demand. Uh-oh, right? What a difference 6 days makes, right?
I'll tell you what's interesting. So I had a series of emails right before the deep sea news came out over the weekend, and I'd spent 2 or 3 days, you know, having conversations back and forth, like just calm down. It was like there was this sheer panic to buy Oklo, some of these small nuclear reactors after Trump announced, you know, we're going to build these things and get it set up. And I'm like, just be patient. Don't chase right here. These things have moved real fast. We'll get our opportunity. And then the news comes out over the weekend. The stocks get hammered on that Monday. And, you know, some of them were like, okay, you know, just forget what I had to say. And I'm like, no, I like it long term, but this is the reason. Just be patient. Let's let these things unfold. Mm-hmm. And Craig, I don't know. We're not going to know until later in the year. But my thesis for this year is that we're going to have a topping process in these markets very similar to what happened in the year 2000. So you had all this back and forth, and you had this increased volatility, and you had all this fear of missing out, and you've got this up and down, but you had a sideways range that basically developed out until mid-year. I can't remember exactly when it was, around May. You just talked about this somewhere.
Yeah, so this is 2007. I just happen to have that chart available. But most people think of were you talking 2000, or did you want to see 2000 itself?
No, we can talk 2007, because I've been through both of those.
Yeah, because a lot of people remember 2008, like this is the drop of October 2008, like that was it. Like, no, it actually topped in October of 2007.
Yes, it did.
And then it's going down. Look at this. It went all the way down. People are like, oh, no. And then look at this huge, this in the time, in the moment, this was a pretty big bump back up. But as they say, low or high, right?
Now, that's February of 2008, correct?
Yep.
Right there. Yep. I can't see the numbers quite correct. So you know what happened in February of 2008? Bear Stearns collapsed.
Wow.
So Bear Stearns collapsed in February of 2008. Market sold off and then rallied right on the other side of that. Then you had commodities that were surging all the way into the summer. And then the market started rolling over towards August. And then when Lehman Brothers collapsed, it was on.
And that's right here. And then, but again, look at all this volatility, and there's lots of opportunities for greed and fear, hopes and, you know, dashed hopes. But the pattern was it's rolling over. But most people don't know that it actually topped there, which is October 1st, 2007.
And that's what makes it so hard, because I like what you have on the right, because most people remember or they think that 2007 was this just immediate collapse. And they get so worried about, you know, I got to get out because the market's going to immediately collapse. So from our standpoint, what we're looking at is looking for topping processes, how much of the market is participating. So I'm going to talk about two extremes going back to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So market tops, momentum starts rolling over. You sell off into February with the Bear Stearns collapse. The market bounces on the other side of that because I think Bernanke was Fed chair in early 2008, yep. Right?
He was.
So he's, you know, I'm going to throw money from helicopters, all this stuff that they were talking about. Hey, the Fed's got it taken care of. We're fine. The amount of fear of missing out and FOMO that I saw from investors from February until about May of that year was the greatest that I had seen outside of the past 3 to 4 months. Well, since the election. Okay.
Really?
I think I told you 2 or 3 times, like, I've never seen this much FOMO in my career. That was the second most. And, you know, so you get into the summer and commodities were taking off, and then the market starts to sell off and it gets really, really ugly. Now, so for those investors who were paying attention in our strategy actually had us starting to get defensive in November of 2007 because the market topped, but that momentum had rolled over. Under the surface, there were only a few stocks that were leading. Now, jump to where we are right now. Last year, value strategy got crushed. The Russell 2000 is basically at the same level it was back in May of this year, somewhere around there approximately. I had a lot of hope right after the election because small caps took off, but in December they got hammered. And then we're back to this Magnificent Seven that's leading the market. So you have an unhealthy market when you have a small handful of companies that are leading the way, but the large majority are not participating. Okay. So I'm laying that. Now let's go back to November of 2008. One of the most amazing things that I've ever seen and learned from an investing standpoint. So I was having to rely on Tom Dorsey at the time, which was doing one of our research. Yes.
This is the S&P. I was showing the Dow before, and the scale doesn't go to zero, so we can dial in and see it a little bit more. This is 2008, and we're by quarter here, so this would be November of 2008. This is the October-November piece right here. From about 1,100 to 850.
Okay.
That's...
Yeah. Right at that bottom in November of 2008, the large majority of the stocks bottomed. Now, we got that rally. The market didn't bottom until May, March, April, May, somewhere, wherever that is in that chart. That's that
2009. Yep.
I think it was May of, was it April? Anyway, y'all bear with me. I'm in the general direction. The market indexes bottomed in May. But the large majority of the stocks had bottomed in November of the year before. So they had bounced, but they didn't break that November low. And that was the indication that the worst part of the decline was over because your big leaders finally puked. So imagine a situation where the small stocks are dropping now. And let's say the market sells off in February. We rally on positive, you know, hope into the spring. And then the small stocks continue to be... you know, decline. But then when your Magnificent Seven and your big stocks puke, that's when the market gets the worst part. But we always look for at tops, we look for broad participation, which we don't have a lot of that right now. And at bottoms, we look for the large majority of the stocks to not make lower lows while big stocks make lower lows. So I still believe we're in a topping process, Chris. I mean, that information can change. You know, there's a lot of things that are changing quickly right now, but bull markets and euphoria and this much fear of missing out don't die easy. That's why tops are a process and bottoms are typically an event.
Oh, I love you saying that. By the way, for those keeping score at home, the low here was 666 on the S&P. I remember that number.
I do too.
It's quite the number. But talk about the tops being this big, long process. This is from 2000. So this is the whole 2000 time, right? And man, Paul, this was painful because all through this period, I was an executive. I was earning good money finally after a lot of school. I was a genius like everybody. And then this started to happen, and I just hung on way too long. I rode some dogs down. I had WorldCom. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just following my broker. He's like, oh, this is great, you know, put me in stuff. And I felt like we were all geniuses together. And then, of course, I realized, you know, we weren't. But just noting that all that volatility, all that, like, I bet even here people are, I was one of them, like, no, it's coming back. No, it's coming back. Nah, it's coming back. Oh, look, it's coming back. I told you, you know, but it just keeps doing that, you know, until you finally get to a bottom. Was that the same sort of bottoming process where you started to see that shift of leadership and you know, smaller ones sort of sitting pat and the big ones finally had to puke? Did you see that there too in 2001 too?
Yeah, that one was a little bit different. So one thing that was interesting during the 2000 to 2003 time frame is value stocks were cratered in 1999. That's another type and shadow of what happened last year. Value in general was obliterated as a strategy last year.
Okay, so back here we're seeing value just sort of getting crushed, even as everything else is sort of going higher.
Yes, so here's what's interesting. So these numbers are going to be approximate, guys. So I tend to round to an easy number to remember. Mm-hmm. But so Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway, we got to agree, he's a legend. But I remember back then, so Buffett was down 19% approximately in Berkshire Hathaway in 1999, while the S&P was up 20. So, you know, Jim Cramer's calling for his removal from Fed chair, whatever, not Fed chair, from Berkshire Hathaway. He doesn't know what he's doing. It's the new normal. When the market came apart from 2000, 2003, one thing that did occur was there was rotation back into some of those value stocks. So it was a little bit different because those stocks were, you know, Berkshire Hathaway was up, if I remember correctly, 38% or so, while the S&P was down 47 over that period of time. Those numbers are approximate, so don't hold me to that specifically. The point is value was up. So the thing that was different in 2003, 2002, 2003, when we got the bottom, U.S. equities had outperformed every other category for the prior 10 to 12 years, dramatically so. But commodities bottomed about 6 to 9 months before the U.S. markets bottomed, and emerging markets bottomed with the U.S. markets and then rip-roared up into the 2007. I think we're going to see some type of a similar type of process now, because we're seeing some indication that commodities are the place to be. So I'll share some charts to show you what I'm referencing here. But yes, to answer your question in general, the large majority of the stocks bottomed before the indexes did, because the cap weighting of the indexes caused them to puke. So just for reference purposes here, for those of you who are listening and may not be seeing, I'm showing a chart going back to January 1st of 2008 of just the major indexes. So the black line is the S&P 500 index. So to put this in perspective, as of today, the S&P 500 index since January 1st, 2008 is up 311%. Now, the next line that I'm going to point out is the blue line, which is the commodities index. Over the same period of time, the Goldman Sachs commodities index is down 7.3%. In 17 years, it's 7.3% below where it was then. Now, emerging markets, which is our green line, is down approximately 12.4%. And developed markets, which is your Canada's, your Australia's, your Europe, has had a total return of 4.5%. Now, this outperformance of U.S. is fueled. I read a report yesterday, something like 65% of global dollars are allocated towards the U.S. equity indexes. So with that being said, I don't have the daily data because it costs money to go all the way back, but it's approximately the same, not same numbers, but from 1990 to December 31st of 1999, the S&P 500 was up, I think that's 318 there. I've got something over it that I can't quite see. So 317, 318%. Everything else was somewhere between, you know, approximately negative 2 to 68 over that period. These numbers aren't exact because that data doesn't go all the way back. But the point is U.S. equities outperformed dramatically. Now, look at this. So talking about that 2000 bottom, commodities in blue started to initially take off, and then they were pulled down with everything else, but they found the bottom in late 2001. And by the time the U.S. equity index bottom in October of 2002, they were up approximately 20 or 30%. So they had taken off. And then you had emerging markets take off. And over that 7-year period, commodities were up 213. Emerging markets were up 155%. U.S. equities had a total return of negative 0.06 from January 1st of 2000 to December 31st of 2007. So, you know, that's interesting data, Chris, but that's a rebalancing that took place in the market that's a little bit different is what I'm really expecting to unfold over the next 3 to 7 years.
Indeed. And I love that context. And by the way, you mentioned, you know, that Warren Buffett was a goat coming into that. And then he was a hero. Look at this. This is the latest cash position. Last time I think we talked, he had a $250 billion or something. He's got nearly a third of $1 trillion of cash. He must not know what he's doing, right, Paul?
So you're telling me, Chris, that the legendary investor that everybody quotes but nobody wants to act like, okay?
Correct.
It's let's quote Buffett, but I don't want to act like him.
Mm-hmm.
Has no FOMO, fear of missing out, and has accelerated in a dramatic fashion the amount of money that he's parked in treasuries.
Yes. In a single year, he's doubled it.
Yeah, I did know that data, but I want to stress this for the listeners that are out there. Warren Buffett is a legend. Number one, and it'd take me a minute to pull up, but you know, when we did that historical analysis, 1974 forward, and all of the periods that I run from retirement plan analysis was the number one performing period. So he had the wind at his sails, but I respect him so much, and I pay attention to what he says because he has a strategy and he follows that strategy. He has the courage to stick to it. And he will take the path less traveled, not just to be contrarian, but because his tools tell him to. And I can tell you, based on how value performed last year and what we're seeing in the undersurface of the market, I understand exactly why he has a cash hoard. And he's not worried about that. He's not worried that his brother-in-law is going to brag about, you know, returns. And I have a good brother-in-law for those of y'all that are out there. It's just a good example for people to listen. Mm-hmm. I had somebody one day say, you must not like your brother-in-law. So it's just an example. I hear that. Or, you know, you've got a brother, a sister, a coworker that's just euphoric about, you know, the returns. And then you take somebody like Warren Buffett, who's already at the exit and shoveling some of his profits outside. And he's going to be in a position to buy when there's blood in the streets because he's got money on hand. If you're fully invested all the time, how can you take advantage of a major recession and the declines that take place in prices if you're a passive investor? Because, you know, what happens if you lose your job during that period of time? You're not going to lose your savings. You're not going to have your savings and emergency funds to deploy that capital. So if you're not in a position to run a strategy to raise risk, yeah, you might miss some opportunity. But Buffett's proven over time that if you have a strategy that you'll follow, you can win over time, even though you may look foolish in short periods. And 2 to 3 years are short periods.
All right. I agree. And by the way, just to be very clear, I am super bearish on the overall data center story at this point, because if we had achieved a 95% reduction from the DeepSeek sort of inference computing power required, we have plenty of data centers to last us quite a while. Now, we'll fill them up again. We're going to find, you know, Jevons paradox was this. Jevon was an 18th century economist, and he said the paradox is that as you make energy cheaper, people use more of it, not less, right? Like, oh, look, we're putting energy efficient appliances in people's houses. They'll use less. No, you end up using more. And it's a paradox. And why does it happen? It happens because as things become cheaper, people use more of them. It's not really that hard of a paradox to understand. So this just made AI a lot cheaper. Therefore, we're going to use a lot more of it, right? Because now it's going to be everywhere. It's going to be in your phone. Eventually, they'll find a way to squish it down into your refrigerator. I'm not sure I'm looking forward to that day. I'm just telling you what's going to happen.
Hey, it'd be nice if you can train it to say, make sure that I don't buy anything when I go to the grocery store that's got all this artificial, horrible stuff.
Yes, yeah.
In the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll just have a little shock collar as you reach towards the pimentos. They're like, no, There's MSG in there. Stop it.
As long as I can choose to set the setting for myself and I don't have somebody else doing it, I'm just fine with that.
The shock collar setting? You betcha.
My wife said that I'll never be able to touch the chocolate pantry at 11 o'clock at night again, ever.
Not without squawking. Ow.
You hear me squealing in there.
All right, so Schwartz have thrown in the towel. It's been a long, 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 long run of up and to the right. And so the reason this is important is because Schwartz often give you your bottoms, right? Because there are people who have a compelling interest to buy regardless of what the overall conditions are, as long as they've locked in a profit. And so Schwartz tend to make the bottoms. We don't have a lot of Schwartz kicking around.
No.
Yeah, not too many. I'm not sure how this square. This is shares short, so I'm not sure how this squares up with all the puts and all the other stuff options that are out there. I'm going to bet most people are shorting by puts these days than actual shares. But this is interesting. So I'm unfortunately familiar with SEC laws and rules because of all the work I did on the Great Taking. So I was actually familiar with this one. Knew this was coming. Part of the Reg SHO. So rule 13F-U, so boring, right? Actually, it's Wiz 888999 or at OBD, ODB 123 is writing here. Hedge funds might need a fresh change of clothes, particularly maybe underwear, because the new rule forces institutional managers to report their short positions via form SHO, meaning the days of hiding in the shadows are over. No more sneaky shorting without the world watching. Hedge funds hitting certain short position thresholds now have to spill the beans to the SEC. It's going to be published on Edgar, so everybody gets to take a peek at that. Normally, they kept that pretty hidden. Market makers now have to fess up when they're shorting under the bona fide market-making excuse. It turns out, Paul, that market makers were allowed to naked short, meaning they sold shares they literally didn't have to locate for a period of time. All that now they have to tell you. This could have a big change. This comes into play in about 12 months. So it's on the books in 12 months. They have 12 months to sort of clear this out. And yep, that's what happens. This is from the fact sheet from the SEC. Managers' end of month gross short position in the equity security at the close of regular trading hours and the last settlement date of the month is now going to be disclosed on form SHO. That's actually a pretty big change. Sounds wonky, but how do you interpret that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm just sitting here thinking, Mark Cahota is, I'd love to hear kind of, you know, he's like the last standing short seller that's out there and takes those battles. I always enjoy kind of listening to his input. I'm curious how that is. It's disclosed. So number one, I would think that there's going to be lack of manipulation in the market out there from naked shorting. It's going to be out there for everybody to see. I don't know. That's a good question. I really didn't know that was coming through. So that's new information for me. So I've got 5,000 things running through my mind right now. So I'm going to put this on you. What's your analysis and what do you think the ultimate outcome and reason for this is?
Well, it's actually overdue as far as I'm concerned. This was supposed to be part of the Dodd-Frank Act. And this was supposed to be the market itself, as we covered in the Great Taking, is very complicated. Spaghetti, it's tubes and pipes and this's and that's, right? You and I and everybody watching this, we see the stock price sort of at the end of the day and it's reported and there it is, as if it's a thing. But behind that, there's all this settlement that has to happen. You sell a share, I buy a share, vice versa. People are shorting them. There's derivatives. There's this, there's that. There's clearinghouses. It's a very big sort of opaque sort of a mess. And so one of the ideas was, hey, people, entities shouldn't be able to just short shares without us seeing that. And so they had 3 days to settle, T plus three, it was called. Then it went to T plus two. And then to catch up with Europe, we went to T plus one. So now you have 1 day to square and settle these things up, but they still weren't being squared up. And that's what this is about. It's like, hey, if you got shorts, you're going to have to disclose them. Now, I'm surprised they gave them, you know, at the end of the month, you have to disclose. That still leaves room for hanky panky, right? You can be all out of compliance for 28 days, and on the 29th, you close it all up, you know? But listen, if it has to be disclosed now, even if you can sort of goof around for 28 or 29 days out of the month, it's still going to go a long way. I bet there's some skeletons in this closet. I'll bet you there's some failures to settle that are old and stinky in that pile.
And stinky. Well, and the derivatives complex has become so huge from that standpoint. That's my concern about where the great taking has the greatest risk of unfolding. Because, you know, Buffett calls them weapons of mass destruction. And I know that's a little, you know, necessarily different, but naked shorting would be in there. You know, my initial thoughts are, you know, these short sellers will pile in, the market doesn't know it, and then you have these short squeezes they talk about where the market will move violently in the opposite direction. So I wonder if disclosing these is going to remove those massive short squeezes that are in there, because it's not going to be something that's triggered under the surface of the market. It's going to be something that the market's aware of and all participants can see. Because, you know, those short squeezes, the Fed-induced short squeezes, Chris, going back to 2000, really starting in 2014, 15 specifically, is one of the reasons we raised our bar so high to short the market. That I'm glad we did, because there's several times in 2019, 2020, even 2022, that I would have taken positions because we had the same setup as similar to 2007 in minor amounts, that it's like, okay, you know, the Fed's basically obliterating the shorts in there. So I'm curious to see how that'll unfold and impact the market. That's where my mind was going and thinking about it.
Well, the Fed has abused the shorts. They've driven them out of the markets. Like, your presence isn't wanted. No shorting the markets. Markets go up and to the right, you know? And of course, that doesn't make a market, because we talked about with the creative destruction in tech shares, sometimes things go up, sometimes they go down. It should happen, right? Some stocks should zero out or go away because they got outcompeted, and that's fine. That's actually welcome as far as I'm concerned. Let me go here real quick. So you and I talked about this very quickly in the South. This is Florida and Texas housing inventory. We talked about this before, but I want to put it up again. A 268% inventory surge from kind of low levels in 2022 there, post-COVID and all that. But that's a pretty big climb. So I'm starting to already hear, this was an important thing. I was talking with a gentleman who's very well-versed in the real estate space. Hello, Clyde, if you're listening to this. And he said, listen, Chris, you know, inflation is put together with OER, owner equivalent rent, is one of its prime. It's a big component. It's supposed to capture the cost of housing. It's a weird thing, Paul. You know, OER is the BLS calling you up and saying, Paul, if you were going to rent your house, how much would you rent it for? And I'm like, asking existing homeowners, that's a weird thing, because they might not have been in the market. They don't actually know what rentals are. It's a weird question to ask them, right? That's not where I would go. I would just go on Zillow and say, how much are rentals right now, right? Data, you know, that would be easier. At any rate, his position is that when you owner's equivalent rent is this weird, sticky, bizarrely formulated survey question, whereas from his experience in these markets in the South, he's like, rents are down high single digits, closing in on double digits in a lot of markets. Therefore, when OER catches up to that, like 6, 7, 8, 9% declines, he is expecting to see actual deflation officially. That's what the statistic is going to show. It's going to show, because it might not be what you're experiencing at the egg counter, but I'm just saying how it's reported. Right now, it's at what, 3.4, something like that, 3.4%? Well, if we take OER and we take that from its current 3.8% and drop that to minus 3.8%, that's just going to drag the heck. He's actually, out of the CPI, he's expecting deflation, therefore lower interest rates, and he's building stuff around that. But you have to look at the fact that that's actually a Southern thing. Great chart here from Nick Gurley. Says it's probably his favorite housing market graph right now. Orange line is that inventories in Florida and Texas we just looked at, but blue line, inventory across the entire Northeast. No inventory.
That's amazing to me, Chris. That is absolutely amazing. You know, and so the question I would ask is, does that have to do with the migration from the Northeast to the South? Because, I mean, our areas have exploded in population here across the board, which has fueled, you know, goodness gracious. I mean, I don't even think that there was this much euphoria around housing coming into the 2007 top down here in this area. So is it that? Is it we have less regulations here? I mean, we have ridiculous regulations compared to what they used to be, but it's easier to build here versus easier to build in the Northeast. Or is it the migration, or is it a combination of both? I'm shocked by that, quite frankly.
Well, I guess we're just not building houses up here either, you know, and New England is a little bit harder to build houses in because it's you know, pretty built up, to be honest, in most places. Like, if you wanted to build more houses around Boston, there's not, like, spare lots hanging out. You got to go pretty far out to find empty land and all of that. So I'm going to guess that, you know, because of that huge migration that happened, there was a lot of inventory that got created because a lot of homes got built across the South. Apartment complexes, multifamily, single family, you name it. And now the way I interpret this is just that building continued, and I might be totally wrong on this, but my guess is the building continued, but the migration slowed down.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That's ridiculously impactful. Now, the one thing that we had in 2008, if it's not different this time with that much inventory... 2008, you had the forced foreclosures of the banking system. So the banks don't own the large majority of the mortgage. The government owns them now. So that's probably going to take a little bit pressure off of, and there seemed to be a desire to take down the small banks back then and consolidate. You know, you hear what Mark Andreessen said about the prior administration wanting to have just a few handful of technology companies. Well, he came out of the administration that basically took down all of the small local banks, gave guarantees to the larger regional banks, and then raised the entry to get into the banking business higher. So it looks like that was the same thing back then that exacerbated that 2008 crisis. You know, that's deflationary. And one of the things that I'm considering now, I'm looking at all things across the board, is I'm actually more concerned that we're going to have some deflation over the next 6 to 12 months, in line with what your friend there was saying. Because one, exporting of all these illegal immigrants that are criminals, okay, mm-hmm. I don't know how many has been exported at this point, and I'm not for illegal immigration. I am for legal immigration. We want the best in this country, but go through it the legal way, right? Okay, so I'm not getting into that. But the reality is, let's say there's 1.5 million that leave because they shouldn't be here, and they mm-hmm. and they have to start that process. Well, from what I understand, the prior administration was spending ridiculous amounts of money, and I think that you had highlighted one of the cities where the mayor had increased the rents dramatically because they were a sanctuary city for all these immigrants that were coming in, right? So there was all of this lining of the pockets that were of the politically connected people. You take 1.5 million out, with inventories getting higher, that's down on rental prices, I would assume. Interest rates higher, I'd still think we're going to have this lag effect that's just taking a lot longer to impact than most people thought. But we're starting to see, I'm talking to a lot of real estate agents around here, the number of listings they're getting in the North Georgia area right now is increasing dramatically. So VRBO rentals aren't making as much as they were before, you know, so we could have some deflation in the short run, which would be the surprise. And then the question on the other side of that is, what's the government response going to be? You know, do we get some deflation, markets get in trouble, and that gives them the cover to just unleash the printing presses? And then that would be a game changer for behavior going forward and investment allocation as well.
Now, so many great points in there. Let's pick one of those threads, though. I feel the deflationary pressures, and I think those are correct. On the other end of this, Janet Yellen left the incoming administration a time bomb. We've talked about it before, right? Which was that actually, surprise, you know, the debt ceiling got hit on January 21st, the day after Trump's inauguration. And then now the clock is running. Most people are unaware of this, but right now the government, at that moment, that clock started running. You can't borrow new. You can't expand the debt in the treasury markets. They had $630 billion in the bank, which sounds like a lot. That's about 2 months of deficit spending, or maybe a month and a half. So the clock is running. We're watching very contentious nomination hearings right now across all sorts of key positions, right? That's just been happening this week and last week. Coming out of that, I think I just see the most fractured government I've ever seen. Like, we're not having the same conversation, right? You know, about Bobby Kennedy, Cash Patel, whatever. What happens if they can't come to some sort of like budget agreement or, you know, debt ceiling raise, and it's just pure politics and the Dems are out for blood or the Republicans don't want to get whatever politics? I could see that becoming actually fairly turbulent over the next few months And if it spills into the treasury market, things get wicked turbulent. Now we're down to things that affect the plumbing and piping, and now we're talking great taking stuff. So how do you see that playing out?
No, I agree with you from that standpoint. And I want to share that chart from Samantha Leduc that
yeah, please do.
Because this is very important as a backdrop on what we're talking about here. So this is just amazing to me. I mean, this makes me so angry. You cannot tell me that Janet Yellen was a fiduciary as the Treasury Secretary in this case. So this is by Samantha Leduc. She does great work. Bissett confirmation expected Monday at 5:30. He resigns over the first QRA February 3rd at 3 Eastern time. He has to tackle a whopping $10 trillion debt stack maturing this year. What's the trade? You know, and that's the question. So look at this. So this is a chart going all the way out to 2054. 2024 had a little over $2 trillion. And coming into 2025, we got, you know, nearly $10 trillion. What's that? $9.5 trillion worth of debt maturity that they left this administration. That's a hand grenade. Okay. So what if we get a beef?
Yeah. Wow. What's that hole? Is that 35, 36?
That's 35, 36, 38. It looks like if there's anything maturing, it's so minimal that it doesn't even come in line. But why?
Yeah, but that means that when they had the chance to roll 10-year paper in 24, 25, like they just didn't do it. At some point in the past, they didn't put any paper there. They pushed it all on the front end of the curve, which we're seeing in that big middle finger you got pointing out right there.
Yeah, and that's a good explanation for those of you who can't see the chart. It looks like a big middle finger that they left Trump. And from my standpoint, that's just, I mean, I don't know legally enough that this is criminal, but it's certainly immoral to not take advantage. We had the historically low interest rates, and you could have stacked that out all the way to 2040, 2050, 2054, and set up the American people to where that's something that could be dealt with over time. Mm-hmm. The only thing that, you know, the one argument that makes sense on why would they do this? Okay, why would they do this? Janet Yellen left the Federal Reserve and then goes over to the Treasury. Okay, so supposedly the Federal Reserve's doing quantitative tightening and interest rates are rising. Well, technically that should have been bad for the market historically, but there's an argument that I don't fully understand, but I understand it enough to where I think I understand what the argument is, but I don't understand it enough to educate people. If you can educate people, you really know. But there's the argument out there that the reason that Janet Yellen had all of these short-term maturities is they provide a lot of liquidity to the market and in effect operate like quantitative easing. Now, I don't understand the banking system enough to know exactly why, but there's some really smart people that have been wise over time that have been making that argument and saying this was by default juicing the markets for political purposes coming into the 2024 election. If that's the case, that goes back to the theme that you and I had talked about 6 months ago or 9 months ago. My concern is that they're going to run this thing so hot that if they win the election, they're in control, so they don't care. And if they lose the election, they're handing Trump, you know, an engine that's about to seize on the other side. So, you know, that's a lot of debt to mature, and it's supply demand. So if the market's really strong, Chris, why in the world are you going to walk away from the market to go buy treasuries in that magnitude? Because most of the portfolios out there and pensions are mechanical, right? So it's going to have to take something to trigger that demand to cover that massive of a, as you said, middle finger of maturity in treasuries this year. I think that's a big deal. I don't know how it impacts the market, but I think that's a big deal.
When you look at this, I mean, yes, I know we've got $36 trillion in debt and percentages are stacked across what we'd call bills, bonds, and notes. But those bills are the real short ones, right? Year and under. Mm-hmm. To get that $10 trillion all stacked in a single year, you got to kind of work at it a little bit, I think. When you're talking about intent, you know, did they mean to leave such a stiff middle finger goose egg? Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I mean, I would have been tempted sorely to sort of spread that out a little bit. But about the, this is really important. So a lot of people, oh, you know, the Fed's doing quantitative tightening right now. Indeed, their balance sheet is walking down. Sounds like they're being responsible, but all they did was hand the baton to Janet Yellen. All right, so that $2 trillion of deficit spending for the U.S. government, which was sometimes as much as $500-700 billion a month. What did they do? You're $600 billion in the hole. What do you do? Well, you go out to the Treasury market and you float $600 billion more that month. What happens? You get $600 billion of cash. What do you do with that? Well, you spend it. How do you spend it? Well, you might spend it on interest payments. This is just interest payments paid to overseas holders. I put it in quotes because a lot of people might think, oh, that's foreigners. Not necessarily. There are offshore money center accounts in the Caymans in London where the account holders may or may not be foreigners. They may be U.S. citizens. I don't know. But that $205 billion that went out in 2024, that's real cash. It's real liquidity. It's what does liquidity do? It goes into the markets. And by the way, it wasn't just a little, it was a lot. Let me see if I can make sure that, let me pull this down because we don't need to hear the sound on this. Awesome chart here from Eagley pointing out this is U.S. interest payments compared to defense spending in the United States starting in 1947. We'll just start this thing running. So you can see in pinkish purple, whatever, however you interpret that color, national defense spending was a lot more than interest payments on the national debt. That was the Vietnam War right there. That drove the inflation. Same thing. Oh, look at interest payments starting to catch up, though. Okay. Weird. National defense actually started to wobble down a little. Look at that. Look at that. Interest payments touched, just were slightly higher for a second. Oh, the interest payments are losing out now. They're just losing out to national defense, which, you know, oh. Strong close. Yeah, that was a heck of a finish there. So that last bit, that let me get my little lasery thing. This, Paul, this is pure liquidity. It goes out. It's cash. That's cash out the door. You borrowed the cash. You put the cash back out. So that's very stimulative. So that operates the same as quantitative easing, because quantitative easing is just putting more cash out into the markets. Fine. That's cash. When they pay the interest payments, they don't, there's no debt rollover in the U.S. government. I mean, you could if you wanted to, but technically they pay you the cash. You decide what you want to do with it. $1 trillion of fresh, hot cash out into the markets. That's what that represents. That's what that is.
You know, I got to give kudos to Samantha LeDuc for her statement. She said, when interest rates go up, it's going to be inflationary because of exactly that right there. And at first, I was like, I don't know about that, just because, you know, and historically, interest rates go up, market corrects down. But the more I thought about it, the more I tried to pick her argument to pieces. And then you look back at what's happened, it has been inflationary in a lot of areas because that's just a ton of cash coming in the economy. And that's amazing that we got ourselves in a position of being so foolish with low interest rates that we thought things would be different this time. And then you know, inflationary pressures cause it to go higher and we get in that situation.
Yeah.
And well, that much to foreigners.
What's that?
That much to foreigners. That's not, I mean, we're right. So we're sending that out and that's money that we don't have to reinvest back in the infrastructure and capital of our own citizenry.
Yeah.
Because of foolish borrowing and foolish spending.
Yeah. Roughly speaking, 1/5 of our interest payments go offshore.
Yeah.
Off they go. I hinted at this at the beginning. So in the time we have left, Paul, I want to talk about the one thing that would make me just ridiculously slobberingly bullish. Just caution to the wind. I don't care. And it's this.
America is going to be very rich again, and it's going to happen very quickly. It's time for the United States to return to the system that made us richer and more powerful than ever before. Do you know, the United States in 1870 to 1913, all tariffs, and that was the richest period in the history of the United States, relatively speaking. In other words, relatively. And they set up the Great Tariff Commission of 1887, and this commission had one function, what to do with all the money that we took in. It was so enormous that they had no idea. It was a blue ribbon committee was set up 1887, and what to do with all of the money that we had. And Again, Teddy Roosevelt was a beneficiary because when McKinley was killed, he took over this vast sum of money and he did all of those national parks and all of the other things. And I'm not knocking him, but he was given a vast amount of money. And that was all made through tariffs. As we had no income tax. The income tax came in 1913. As I said in my speech last week, instead of taxing our citizens to enrich foreign nations, we should be tariffing and taxing foreign nations to enrich our citizens. Does that make sense, right?
So he's talking to the Congressional Institute, and he just like chucks that out there, like, you know, maybe we should consider not taxing our own citizens. That if that happened, that would ignite the biggest animal spirits you just can't even imagine. If people suddenly had money in their pockets that wasn't going to the federal government, that'd be a big deal.
Oh, think about the quality of life that would bring, Chris, because you had the two-income trap. Where's that book? I've got it around here somewhere called The Two-Income Trap and how, you know, both spouses are forced and that's gutted the family. There's some people that are going to continue to work in two-parent families or two-person household mm-hmm. and continue to work, but that's also going to free up. There's many spouses that are going to be able to stay at home and focus more on their family if you're not having to pay income taxes in there, too. You know, that can make a difference. The beneficial impact across the board in our country on the lives of our citizenry and economically. I mean, yeah, that's ridiculously bullish. I'm with you on that. It's like, okay. Guys, well,
I feel like we are a throwback to the 1870s. They used to have robust debates about these things. They would talk about things like what happens when the government spends too much money and how much inflation and what are we willing to accept and what are the trade-offs. We haven't had conversations in a long time. I heard when Trump was speaking and he starts talking eloquently about from 1870 through 1913, all that stuff. I hear Scott Bessent in there because that's that he's known for that. He has that context. And so he said, look, this is a really rich period of our history. We could return there. And here's how we would get there. So that's interesting. And it gets back to this concept for me here, Paul, which is why do we borrow money from a banking system as a nation only to have to pay $1 trillion now of interest back to that same system? Nobody can really answer this question, right? Which is, why are we not in the business? I'll just let this run again. Why wouldn't the Treasury just issue its own currency? Be a U.S. Treasury note. That's it. They put it out there. If inflation starts to get bad, you tax it, you pull it back in. You could be your own Federal Reserve. I get it. Banks are convenient, all of that. But are banks, is having a banking system loan us our own money worth $1 trillion a year? I think with technology, Paul, we don't need to spend $1 trillion, which is what the interest payments represent, having the banking system manage our money. I'll bet you could get some 20-year-olds to code that up in a couple of weeks and run it off a laptop.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, especially with the technology. And maybe that's one of the reasons the push for the digital currency behind digital currency or cryptocurrencies with the Trump administration, because they're pushing in that direction. And
all cryptocurrencies. I mean, sorry, central bank digital currencies.
Central bank digitals, but the cryptocurrencies, yeah.
Right. But he's pushing for you can feel them leaning towards the digital currencies like Bitcoin and things like that. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Correct.
So, yes.
Correct. So, it could that be the backdrop to replace the banking system? Well, you got this activist banking system now, and especially with all the small banks being taken down in 2008. I mean, I remember, and long story short, back in college, I qualified for the National Collegiate Championships. And I mean, I was working and going to school and I didn't have the money. My parents were like, hey, can I borrow
this? Water skiing?
This was in water skiing, yeah.
Yeah.
So I called, you know, it wasn't like golf. I mean, if you were really good, you still weren't making a lot of money unless you were the top two in the world. If you were number five, you were, you know, eating ramen noodles 5 days a week. But my dad's like, No, you got to figure out how to get on your own. So I called the local bank, a small bank up here, and I gave them the story, and I got a signature loan for $700 to go to the national championships, collegiate, which I won, by the way. I normally don't say that, but I'm old enough, and I'm officially a has-been.
Congratulations.
So I can share that now. Thank you. But and even after that, when, you know, a couple of projects that I did, I could go in and get a loan based on my reputation and my signature because I was proven to be a man of my word. They don't care who you are today. They don't want to loan you money unless you don't. But what happened is when those small banks were taken away, the decisions are not made on a local level anymore because there's no skin in the game. You've got a manager on that local level and some back office in a city where they had no clue where you are, and they're politically connected, so they can be an extension of the political elite up there. They're making decisions on where loans are made and directed to throughout the country. Now, I've seen that. You know, I've just seen the change in our local area and how much harder it is. Nobody cares about your reputation locally anymore. It's, do you have the money and do you really don't need it? We'll loan it to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to eliminate that income tax and to get back to free and fair and balanced, if it was a digital currency of some sort or a blockchain based, as long as it's not controlled by the government, could be just a quality of life game changer across the board. Now, there are other ramifications that could come on with it, but if it's used for good, it could be something that's a blessing for us. And to not have to pay income taxes in, think of the ingenuity, think of the reinvestment into the business that would be here. People aren't going to just, consumption may go up in the short run, but there's only so many things that people can buy and they're going to get bored with them at some point. But then they have the free capital to be able to reinvest back into some of the ideas. Businesses are going to be started, new construction across the board, reinvestment back into families. There's money that families will have left over to where they can pay for their kids' college education without having to borrow all this money. If they want to reinvest back into paying their mortgage off to get debt free, it really would remove the shackles from the American citizen. It would be huge.
I really hope everything seems to be on the table, right? So what Trump has done in the first, you know, week and a half here has been extraordinary, right, to me. I can't even keep track of it all. It's like every day I'm like, whoa, new stuff. But he's throwing big things on the table, at least for consideration. I think we should also throw on the table the idea that we don't need to borrow our money into existence from a private banking cartel.
Mm-mm.
We could just issue our own money. Right. You still need private banks to do the loaning and all this and that. I get it. They do perform a service. But that service of going out to a treasury auction, throwing 50, 60 billion into that pile on Monday and getting cash back from a system that just clicked it out of thin air, I don't think that's worth $1 trillion a year. I think we could take that same trillion and plow it back into something like, I don't know, rescuing astronauts from a stranded space station or, you know, rebuilding. Here's how many miles of high-speed rail we have in the United States. Zero. None. The big goose egg. Maybe we could get a few of those. I think that'd be great. I'd love to get on a train in Springfield and get off in New York and or even D.C. and not have to go through that rigmarole of flying, which they've made such an unpleasant experience. You know, yes, unless you like being fondled by strangers or whatever they're up to that day, you know, it's not really that pleasant.
For the listeners out there, I was telling Chris the other day, that my for Will, when he's football, the debate is, do we fly or do we drive? And I'm the one that drives in the family. So Holly doesn't like the airport. None of us really like the airport, especially Atlanta. It's ridiculously busy. So I'm like, I want to fly. I'm willing to get groped and molested. That's this horrible thing to say. That's a terrible thing for somebody that's been molested. But, you know, I'm willing to get groped for the peace of mind of sitting there and not having to drive. But a high-speed rail, oh, my gosh, that would be game-changing. I would love that because you get on there, you're there fast. That's what we need within this country. We need to reinvest here. We're behind the rest of the world in a lot of those areas, high-speed rail, infrastructure, and I know our infrastructure is older and they're rebuilding on the new technology, but we have a responsibility to reinvest back into our country. A good business is going to reinvest back into that business for the future, and that's one of the things that we pay attention to in a dividend strategy is we don't want them to pay out 100% of their earnings in dividends. Okay, there are companies that do that, but they're going to die at some point in the future because if you're not reinvesting back into that business, you're not reinvesting back into the capital to generate that future income. And if you're not growing, you're dying. That's just really the way a company is, right? So we got to reinvest back into this country. And And we're so far behind from that standpoint. Imagine freeing that up. You've got the government that's doing it with tariffs. They're not taking it from the American citizenry. The American citizenry is not paying 40%, you know, 20 to 40% of their earnings on income taxes. And now they're reinvesting back into business ideas and to get themselves some more freedom. The innovation that would come from that, because the American people are, they're all like MacGyver. They just need to be in a position to where they can act like MacGyver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Get the shackles off them. You know, I put out a piece recently about sort of like, has the baton passed to the East, right? Because, you know, there's this old saw out there that China just copies everything. And I heard a lot of that this week. Some of it struck me as possibly informed. Some just sounded like coping. Because the truth is that China didn't copy its circulating, its orbiting quantum satellites from anybody. Nobody else has them. They didn't copy their hypersonic missiles from us because we don't have them, right? They, you know, their thorium reactors, nobody else has them, you know? So there's a lot of things you got to look at and say, all human inventions literally stand on top of all prior inventions at that point in time. So this idea that United States is like this, you know, unparalleled fount of creativity, it can be. I think our people can be super creative, but not when we're you know, overburdened upon. And by the way, that's why I'm such a I'm so frosty about this. Who knows? I'm going to lose my YouTube channel someday because they're going to say I'm just too dangerous and I say things I shouldn't, right? Because they're stifling. Well, but you know, I might, because you know, they're very clear that there's some things they consider bad speech, and I'm like, no. Creativity means unfettered thoughts. It's the freedom. Can you imagine like saying to a comedian, you know, listen, you can do any joke you want, but not about race, not about your wife, not gender, not about anything that happened to you, because that might offend somebody, right? You're out. It's not funny anymore, right? So that creativity requires us to be free as possible, and so that's why I'm really against anything that looks like it's just limiting freedom, right? Clamping us down, 15-minute cities, malinformation that somebody shapeless decides you're on the terror watch list, right? Which happened to Tulsi Gabbard. All those things, Paul, those are the things that I think allow me to ask the question, are we handing the baton to the East? And I think we are, and we got to reverse that. And I hope that's what's on the table here.
I hope so too, because their philosophies are completely different than ours, and it's not going to be good for us from a long-term standpoint. And we need to reinvest. We've got to, there are two things that destroy people, shackles and too much money. Sometimes, especially if you get it when you're young, right? Because it stifles innovation. And we've been so blessed with wealth within our country. I think to an extent it has so distorted our view of reality that we're being bypassed by the rest of the world when we think we're riding on the coattails of former generations that reinvested to put us in the position we're in right now. You know, and you can take two kids, one has to fight a little bit. Challenges are good for us in our lives, and especially for kids, because it gives them a reason to strive and excel for the future. And yeah, so I'm concerned that if Trump is unable to release the regulations and put us in a position, then the brightest days of America are behind us, and darker days are ahead, because weak men bring about hard times.
Totally agree with that. We've used our time up for today, Paul. Thank you so much for your time. For anybody listening, if you want to talk to Paul as an amazing team, you're going to have to get on the calendar. It might take a month, but the first step is to go to peakfinancialinvesting.com. Fill out a simple form, few questions in there, so Paul and his team can begin to orient around what your situation is, and then go through your situation with you. And everybody who has so far has gotten something from it, and I know a lot of them have become clients because it's such an amazing process. So thanks for that. And any last words here?
No, it's my honor. So the one thing I will say is we kind of clamped down mine and Dylan and John's schedule a little bit. So all of us are out a little bit more just because of the fact we got to make sure that we're in a position to talk to our existing clients and take care of them. We've got somebody else new that we brought on the team that's going to shorten that a little bit. We got to get them trained on our philosophies. So we've got all the infrastructure in place. So just be patient. And the one thing I can say that will speed up the process, But, you know, it's a little bit easier for me because a lot of you have heard Chris and I talk for quite some time, but we offer the introductory call. That's just a chance for you to ask me any question that you have. I don't get into recommendations. You can actually skip through that process and go to the intro planning meeting where you give us the information to begin with. And that speeds up that process a little bit. So in that meeting, I typically set aside a little bit more time so that you can ask me any questions you want. But I've already got the data. I've already analyzed your situation. And then we're able to go into looking at your plan. So that's an option for those of you that feel comfortable enough doing that. You give us the information that stays here. We don't share it. It's private. But that allows me to jump right into intro where you can still ask me any question you want. But as soon as you get through those, then we go into the details of your plan. So those are some options for those that want to get in a little quicker.
And I should probably add to that. It's very important to me, and I'm sure to other people. You're independent, right? So there's no back office, you know, that's got some agenda that, you know, you move people into this and that. You just do what's right for people and their circumstances. And that's the guiding ethos of your shop. That's why we work together, because that's the best way to be.
Yeah, that's right. And I forget to tell people that sometimes because it seems obvious. But I mean, my head's 100% on the chopping block. And I don't, you know, I don't work for any company. You know, our custodians are Fidelity, Charles Schwab, a couple of others. We have relationships with them, but I'm not employees of theirs. They don't dictate our investment stance. Everybody that's a part of the research that goes into our portfolios, they're all like us. They're independent. They have to earn the fees that we pay them, the substantial fees that we pay them to do the research that's there. We take that, bring it down to an individual client level, and we pull components from five different sources that we built relationships with over time, and they genuinely care more about doing good for others than they do anything else. So that's the joy of being independent versus, you know, having a corporate firm dictate the decisions that we have to make for you. I mean, there are some firms out there that will not allow their clients to buy gold. Okay. Gold has been the number one performing asset class in broad asset classes since 2000, and they still won't allow their clients to buy it. By the time they change, the gold bubble is going to be ready to pop. And, you know, so that independence makes a difference because it allows us to use the tools that are out there to help you be successful without corporate influence and pay to play and all that stuff. The only person we get our fees from are the clients that we serve. And I will never be in any other position if there's ever an opportunity. You know, if the government mandates it, then I'll die on this hill. Independence matters because that helps us serve our clients.
Indeed. I don't take any just straight advertising dollars from anybody. Same reason. I need to be free, and I need to be able to say whatever I want, and I don't want to have to worry at all about if that's going to offend half my revenue or something like that.
Well, Elon Musk is a little different, but what was it he said? I'm not going to say it on here because I don't want to say the language, but, you know, somebody was talking about him losing dollars, and he said if that bothers them, they can go blank themselves. Isn't that what he said?
Yep, yeah. Go blank yourself, right? All right. Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week again, of course. I'm Chris Martinson with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management, and thank you very much for listening. Comments down below. And we'll get to any of those, of course, at Peak Prosperity. Depending on where you're watching this, come back to peakprosperity.com, and there'll be a whole public conversation there. Ask any questions you want, engage with the conversation, and let's chew on all this information because we want you to be happy, wealthy, and wise. All right, Paul, till next week. Thanks again.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Have a blessed week.